Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and at alexlinder.com when it's ultimately archived. Today we're going to do Part 3, Chapter 17, Washington, D.C., 1974, of Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control by E. Michael Jones of culturewars.com, Catholic intellectual out of South Bend. Book was published by St. Augustine's Press back in 2000. And let's go. This is about a 15-page chapter, longer than the last couple. Part 3, Chapter 17, Washington, D.C., 1974. In January 1974, when Linda Lovelace was still filling seats at the Adult New World Theater in New York City, John D. Rockefeller III was getting ready to attend the World Population Conference in Bucharest with a deep sense of self-satisfaction that comes to the few people in the course of human history who have changed the world by their own efforts. And we've heard in earlier chapters about Rockefeller essentially meeting with the Pope and trying to get the Catholics to change their position on birth control. And, you know, if one won't work with him, another will, and just setting up conferences and essentially finding people who will do what he wants, similar to George Soros, the Jew, today. Instead of being celebrated for his efforts, Rockefeller was in for an unpleasant surprise when the Vatican, the Soviet bloc, and the Third World teamed up to reject his proposals. Bringing the Vatican and the Communists together on an issue was no small accomplishment, and John D. Rockefeller III had done it virtually single-handedly. But having become accustomed to molding public opinion to suit his desires, Rockefeller was not going to be deterred from setting birth quotas throughout the world just because the world didn't want them. Instead, he turned to the United States government, confident that it would accomplish by stealth what he had failed to do by persuasion. One way or another. On April 24, 1974, Henry A. Kissinger inaugurated that new era of subjugation abroad by sending to the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of Agriculture, the Director of the CIA, the Deputy Secretary of State, and the Administrator of the Agency for International Development, with a copy to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a memorandum titled Implications of Worldwide Population Growth for U.S. Security and Overseas Interests. That study came to be known subsequently as National Security Study Memorandum 200, or NSSM 200. That memo stated, "The President has directed a study of the impact of world population growth on U.S. security and overseas interests. The study should look forward at least until the year 2000 and use several alternative reasonable projections of population growth." Immediate occasion for NSSM 200 was the defeat of the United States plan for establishing birth quotas for the world had just suffered at the United Nations-sponsored population conference in Bucharest. There, the Holy See, along with the communist and third world countries led by Algeria, denounced the U.S. and the West for practicing what they called contraceptive imperialism. That's a big thing we've heard from Jones, that Catholics don't like others telling them not to breed. John D. Rockefeller III seems to have taken the rebuff personally and spent the last few years of his life engaging in soul-searching about the population control enterprise, but by then his ideology had become the cornerstone of this country's foreign policy and beyond his power to revoke. NSSM 200 was reaffirmed as the cornerstone of the United States population policies on November 26, 1975, in a separate memo, National Security Decision Memorandum 314, NSDM 314, which endorsed both the policy recommendations in the study and those additional points proposed by Kissinger. It was signed by Brent Scowcroft, and in spite of being declassified in the late 80s, it is still in force. And we associated him with the first Bush, Brent Scowcroft. Rockefeller had changed the world in the nick of time, too. The Bucharest conference took place just months before the population bombers like Paul Ehrlich had predicted that worldwide famine would begin as a result of overpopulation. In addition to books like Paul Ehrlich's Population Bomb and the less famous but even more dire book by the Paddocks, Famine 1975, then-president of the World Bank, Robert S. McNamara, stepped to the podium at Notre Dame before the graduating class of 1969 and announced in the direst terms that the usual date predicted for the beginning of the local famines is 1975 to 1980. In making this statement, McNamara was simply following the lead of people like Paul Ehrlich, who wrote in Population Bomb, quote, "I have yet to meet anyone familiar with the situation who thinks India will be self-sufficient by 1971, if ever." By September 1977, which is to say 2 years after famine was supposed to have devastated India, the Indian grain reserve stood at about 22 million tons, and India began to be faced with a problem of how to store the stocks, quote, "that overflowed warehouses and caused mounting storage costs so that they would not be ruined by rain or eaten by predators." By the mid-70s, India had begun exporting food, but not before they had their own experience of population control at the hands of people like Robert McNamara, who announced to the Notre Dame graduates in 1969 that, quote, "the food-population collision will duly occur." So the guy, the attempts to prevent it or ameliorate it will be too feeble. Famine will take charge in many countries. It may become, by the end of the period, endemic famine. There will be suffering and desperation on a scale as yet unknown. So again, this is one of these supposedly brightest minds who completely messed up the war in Vietnam and blew that, and now he's making massive mistakes on another front. So if you want a guy who basically always gets it wrong but has a high IQ, that would be Robert McNamara. There was he in The Fog of War? I'm trying to remember. There's a long documentary where he discussed Vietnam that could be worth watching. I've only seen a few minutes of it. There was suffering in India, all right, but it wasn't caused by lack of food. It was caused, rather, by people like Robert McNamara. As his solution to the problem of overpopulation, in quotes, because Catholics don't really believe in overpopulation as a concept, Mr. McNamara announced that, quote, "family planning is going to have to be undertaken on a humane but massive scale." And, you know, I knew someone in school who was of Indian descent, and he would tell me they would Indian government would just go into theaters and grab people and sterilize them. So I don't know too awful much about India, but apparently that's probably related to what's going on here, although that's not really very humane. Well, Mr. McNamara got it half right. In India, family planning programs were certainly massive, but they were hardly humane. The record of mass sterilizations done without consent or knowledge to hapless peasants who received a transistor radio in exchange for not having children and then perhaps died of an infection is one of the darkest chapters of the eugenic movement, which is hardly the century's noblest social movement to begin with. Between mid-1975, when Indira Gandhi decided the population emergency, or declared the population emergency, her quote, and when it ended in 1977 with the fall of the Gandhi government, 6.5 million men were given vasectomies, mostly against their will. So it was happening. And a total of 1,774 men died as a result of the operations. During the height of this mayhem, McNamara flew to India to cheer on the Ministry of Health and Family Planning in November 1976, praising the Indian government for its political will and determination in attempting to solve what he continued to refer to as the population problem. According to Kissinger's memo, motivation is a key component to the United States population control program. Key congressional supporters need to be stroked, quote, to reinforce the positive attitudes of those in Congress who presently support U.S. activity in the population field, and to enlist their support in persuading others. Another key aspect is the role of multilateral institutions like the UN, whose involvement as a conduit of U.S. aid money forestalls accusations of contraceptive imperialism. The study notes, for example, that of the 13 countries targeted for contraceptive intervention, India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Nigeria, Mexico, Indonesia, Brazil, the Philippines, Thailand, Egypt, Turkey, Ethiopia, and Colombia, some have already become, quote, receptive to assistance for population activities, In other high-priority countries, however, India and Egypt, for example, U.S. assistance is limited by the nature of political or diplomatic relations, or, in Nigeria, Ethiopia, Mexico, and Brazil, by the lack of strong government interest in population reduction programs. In such cases, external technical and financial assistance, if desired by the countries, would have to come from other donors and or from private and international aid organizations like NGOs, many of which receive contributions from AID. The document states that the U.S. Department of State and AID played in AID, played an important role in establishing the United Nations Fund for Population Activities, UNFPA, to spearhead a multilateral effort in population as a complement to the bilateral actions of AID and other donor countries. It notes repeatedly the need for the indirect approach to population control in the developing world. They need an indirectly approach it, not don't scare them, don't make you think you're threatening their base. And advises, for instance, there is also the danger that some LDC leaders will see developed country pressures for family planning as a form of economic or racial imperialism. This could well create a serious backlash. It acknowledges that the use of multilaterals to achieve U.S. population objectives would require that additional amounts of money be provided to those institutions until such time as population assistance becomes accepted by less developed country leaders. But the use of multilateral agencies to achieve the U.S. foreign policy objectives serves an additional purpose. Quote, it is vital that the effort to develop and strengthen a commitment on the part of the LDC leaders not be seen by them as an industrialized country policy to keep their strength down or to reserve resources for use by the rich countries. Development of such a perception could create a serious backlash adverse to the cause of population stability. The last sentence gives away the purpose of population control, namely the effort on the part of the industrialized countries with low birth rates to hold on to world hegemony by nullifying the demographic advantage of countries where the birth rate is high. And again, as I've said in earlier recordings, they saw that as a way for them to overcome Rome through their high birth rate and their views on marriage. So it's kind of a repeat of that. At its core, the population offensive launched by the neo-Malthusian regime, which took power in this country in the 60s, had two flaws. First, it was fundamentally dishonest. It was imperialism disguised as humanitarianism, with the UN and World Bank acting as front groups. And secondly, the population control offensive only worked where it didn't need to work at all. In other words, it accelerated the demographic decline in the developed world that was the source of neo-Malthusian concern about differential fertility in the first place. Like he said earlier, the Protestants wanted to control Catholic birth rates, but they were the customers of their own plans. They were the ones who were using the birth control. So it somewhat backfired. Population control had no effect in Africa because the Africans hadn't reached the demographic transition, the stage of affluence which must be reached before children are seen as a liability. In the affluent north, where those nations had reached the demographic transition, propaganda for contraception simply made a bad demographic situation worse. The reason population control didn't work in Africa is simple. There is virtually no discretionary income in Malawi. You can't send women to law school in Burkina Faso. Your wife can't get a job teaching part-time in Kenya or working at Kmart in Liberia. Not only is there no excess income in those places, there is no excess population in those places either. In fact, virtually every sub-Saharan country is underpopulated, and underpopulation is the primary cause of famine and poverty there. The most effective instruments in driving down birth rates, affluence, modernization, feminism, education, etc., don't apply in impoverished countries. If the industrialized nations had been honest about providing development, they might have driven birth rates down. But since the purpose of population control was depriving those countries of the economic and political leverage which was based on population increase, the contraceptive campaigns failed across the board. So you see kind of the affinity between the Catholic and the Democratic way of thinking just breed a whole mass of substandard, sub-white level populations, and then they have economic needs and the political ability to leverage that into a massive demand on the better people. But of course, they deny all those they deny any criterion of quality applied to humans, because we're all God's children. So, you know, African with 15 kids is better, in fact, in their view, than, say, a white with 4 or 5. So, the people in poor countries in Africa simply had nothing to lose. And in a situation like that, children were the only tangible assets a couple had, and certainly their only guarantee of support in old age. As a result, the population controllers achieved, in the words of one of their famous memos, little more than the smell of burning rubber. They had little else to show for their efforts as places like Africa continued to pullulate, that is, teem, because the foundations could find no leverage in making them want to stop having children, which they still see as a benefit. There are, of course, the coercive loans floated by the World Bank, but in the absences of a certain level of prosperity, they don't work either. In his book, Nature Against Us, Peter J. Donaldson cites a memo by population controller John Sullivan entitled The Smell of Burning Rubber. The memo in question referred to a request for a grant of $50,000 from the Nepal mission to monitor the burning of condoms whose shelf life had expired and which had, therefore, to be destroyed. In Asia, writes Donaldson, who, it should be remembered, is a defender of the population control programs and worked for them himself, block quote, where 75% of all AID-purchased contraceptives were sent, the problem was too many, not too few, contraceptives. In addition to the smell of burning rubber in Nepal, the AID mission in Bangladesh requested a moratorium on deliveries of oral contraceptives. The mission in the Philippines canceled a $6 million loan, in part because it had discovered at least 3 years' worth of contraceptives in storage. Pakistan had the same problem, as unused supplies exceeded their shelf lives. Within a few years of the installation of NSSM 200 as the cornerstone of the United States foreign policy, as early, in fact, as the late 70s, the efficacy of AIDS programs were being questioned by the population controllers themselves. In fact, as Donaldson himself indicates, the entire population control profession was afflicted with a sense of crisis when his book came out in 1990. The old supply-side solutions popularized by Reimert Ravenholt and his successor at AID during the Reagan years, Peter McPherson, simply did not work and resulted in nothing more in most cases than, as John Sullivan wrote, the smell of burning rubber. Donaldson cites a picture of an aid worker shoveling condoms and pills out of a helicopter as a satire in the program sent to its director as a way of helping him to reorient his priorities, but it had little effect on its intended recipient, perhaps because it had too much truth for comfort in it. As the population controllers came to the conclusion that the Third World wasn't much interested in family planning, they turned increasingly to coercive programs of the sort tried in India and still in place in China. The 1994 UN Conference on Population and Development in Cairo was in many ways an admission of the failure of both family planning of the sort parodied by the man shoveling condoms out of a helicopter, and population control of the nasty coercive sort that got practiced across Asia. In place of both failed alternatives, with their stupid heavy-handedness, their waste of money, and their inherently coercive nature, the UN operatives in Cairo attempted to substitute feminism, women's health, quotes, and development as alternative justifications for driving down the birth rates of developing countries. Reading the oftentimes discouraged reports of the population controllers, one quickly comes to the conclusion that there are essentially two different sorts of community in this world when it comes to birth control. When a country reaches a certain state of affluence or modernization, or both taken together, the couple decides to limit the number of children it has because it sees children as economically disadvantageous. This turning point is known in population control circles as the demographic transition. Once a country reaches it, family limitation happens all by itself. Before it gets reached, which is to say, before a country gets that affluent, no amount of condoms or pills will bring it about, which is currently the state of affairs in Africa, much to the consternation of demographers who fear African fertility. Donaldson argues that far less affluence is necessary than was previously thought to usher in the demographic transition, but he does not dispute its existence. Following the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision in 1973, there was a certain amount of disingenuousness in playing abortion off against contraception, as there was in the Reagan-Bush administrations, which got to portray as a right-to-life victory ever-increasing budgets to limit the fertility of the third world. With victories like this, the poor needed no defeats. The result of this cynical political maneuvering was a self-perpetuating system in which the anti-abortion forces perpetuated population control in the name of fighting abortion. Pro-life conservative Newt Gingrich personally intervened during the summer following the Republican Revolution of 1994, when the House zeroed out funding for Title X and restored funding for population control. Donaldson cites the case of James Buckley, conservative architect of the Mexico City policy, who nonetheless in 1982, as Undersecretary for State for Security Assistance, Science and Technology, served as point man in the fight to save the aid population budget from cuts threatened by the Office of Management and Budget, David Stockman's thing. The Information Project for Africa reports that in Colombia, quote, the early population program became hopelessly mired in criticism coming from all sides. That is, until Planned Parenthood, a long block quote, invented the abortion debate, and the carefully planned diversion paid off. Abortion quickly became the topic of contention, and opponents of the birth control campaign ceased talking in terms of the depopulation program. In comparison to this phantom abortion problem, the American donated rubber seemed the lesser of two evils. And at last, the planners of the global family were able to introduce a variety of contraceptives that weren't contraceptives at all. Such abortifacient drugs and devices as the IUD, certain oral contraceptives, hormonal implants, and injectables. So useful was this distraction that by the early 80s, a Planned Parenthood spokesman was able to proclaim a major victory, saying that religious leaders in Colombia had prudently dropped their opposition to everything but abortion. All of this points out the futility of using the devil to drive out Beelzebub. Those who claim that the funding of contraception will reduce the number of abortions are either disingenuous or misinformed. But the debate over foreign aid and its involvement in population control is useful, even if depressing, because it gives us the best introduction into the real meaning of the so-called sexual revolution. Chesterton used to define birth control as no birth and no control. In this, he was half right. Contraception means no birth, and it means no self-control, but the absence of self-control in matters sexual invariably means the presence of instruments of political control. The absence of self-control in matters sexual invariably means the presence of instruments of political control. So, like, kind of a variation on the manners or morals. You either have to have manacles or morals. You either have to have internal self-control to not commit crime, or there will be manacles provided for you. So here, if you don't have sexual control, then the government's going to control and reorient you from the outside. And he says, and I cut that off, but he says, the absence of self-control in matters sexual invariably means the presence of instruments of political control. So self-control or political control, and the instruments of political control which fill the moral vacuum created by immoral action. And again, remember always his big theme is no progress outside the moral order. So that's the number one thing to him. And he's always critical of those like Protestants who by technical means try to redress what is essentially a moral problem. To put the cart before the horse before the cart, to put things, in other words, in their proper order, the sexual revolution was the domestic version of the same adventure in political engineering that got imposed on the rest of the world under the name of population control. So sexual revolution in the U.S. and population control abroad. At first glance, it seems as if we were dealing with two different things, one imposed on others from without, one embraced willingly by the victims themselves in the name of liberation. But those distinctions are really not the crucial distinctions. A better description of the dichotomy might be between rhetoric and reality. Population control programs are always portrayed as something helpful in public statements, but invariably they are proposed as debilitating to the countries on the receiving end in classified documents. Bridging the gap between rhetoric and reality are books like Donald Warwick's Bitter Pills, in which the author announces that, quote, although the guiding objective of national policy was to reduce Kenya's birth rate, the publicly announced rationale for family planning was the spacing of births for improved health. So we pretend we're doing it for your benefit when it's really for ours. This leads us to the first hermeneutical rule in understanding hermeneutics is interpretation. In understanding the true meaning of population control, health is always a code word for weakening the country demographically. This truth leads us to other more basic truths. For example, the truth that population is an asset to a country and not a liability, a fact which emerges when one reads military assessments of population. In a series of memoranda issued by the National Security Council in the mid-1970s, the NSC discussed the probable consequences of decreasing population growth in the United States and increasing population growth in the Third World. The most basic fact is that the United States and its Western allies are declining as a percentage of world population. Whereas 6% of the world's people resided in the United States in 1950, the U.S. accounted for only 5% of the world's people in 1988, and its population is expected to be no more than 4% of the world total by the year 2010. The results of this demographic decline in terms of ability to field an army and wage a war are clear. Quote, declining fertility rates will make it increasingly difficult for the United States and its North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, allies, and the Soviet Union and its Warsaw Pact allies alike to maintain military forces at current levels. Block quote. That demographic fact, in effect, diffused the East-West confrontation and may have contributed to its ultimate resolution following the collapse of the Soviet Empire. However, unlike the former Soviet Union and other Warsaw Pact nations, the nations of the Southern Hemisphere have birth rates much higher than those of the West, leading to a North-South confrontation that will succeed the Cold War as the major area of military concern for people like the folks at the National Security Council. The same analysis that saw a demographic standoff in East-West relations projected that exceptionally high fertility rates in the developing world could lead to expanded military establishments in affected countries as a productive alternative to unemployment, and that developing nations may have a built-in momentum to capitalize on unused manpower for purposes of both internal and external security. And, of course, we see these masses of millions and millions of people invading Europe. The same NSC document also examined the effects of declining population in the West, projecting that the increasing ratio of elderly people to working-age people would reduce the production of productive workers, or reduce the proportion of productive workers, while at the same time increasing the need for social services, thus reducing available revenues to the military. Moreover, it said, the aging of society implies a reduction in productivity and the possibility of economic stagnation, and could also mean less overall money exists because the productive population base has shrunk. Decline in fertility and birth rate, in other words, means a decline in national power and military might. If this is true for the U.S. military, it is true for other countries as well. So U.S. aid in developing other countries lower their birth rates is really an attempt by the U.S. to weaken them militarily, as the NSC document and other recently declassified documents make perfectly clear. The drop in the quantity of people also means a change in quality as well. The NSC memo indicates that the population within the United States, too, is changing, quote, as the proportion of blacks, Hispanics, and Asians increases. The report questions whether the U.S. Armed Forces will be able to recruit the quality, quote unquote, of personnel needed for the high-tech wars of the future. Quote, one of the most important questions facing the U.S. military in the years ahead under the all-volunteer conditions will be not whether it can recruit the required quantity of manpower, but whether it can entice the required quantity with the required qualities to join it. It states, aptitude requirements in certain high-tech jobs currently would disqualify as many as 70% of the male population and almost 90% of all otherwise eligible women. As the population continues to shrink, the NSC memo continues, competition to fill vacancies undoubtedly will intensify between the military, colleges, and civilian employers. As this competition intensifies, recruiting costs seem likely to escalate, and pay levels will have to be increased to keep pace with the civilian job market. Pumped up pay or bonuses for enlistment and reenlistment, when combined with other defense expenditures, could seriously squeeze the federal budget. A bad demographic situation for the United States is even worse for the nations of Europe, where birth rates have fallen even further below replacement level. The increasing manpower shortage among NATO countries will bring about, quote, increased tension over conventional burden sharing, even a heightened possibility that the alliance's forward defense posture will unravel. But as Darwin and his followers recognized, the real danger of a declining birth rate arrives when it is matched by another population which is increasing, the fate of the North vis-a-vis the South, which threatens to displace its affluent neighbors by replacing them over the course of a few generations. Africa, because it is the fastest growing region of the world, is a cause of special concern. Between 1988 and 2010, the NSC study reveals, Africa's population will more than double to 1.2 billion, about 16.6% of the global total. Between 1985 and 2030, the total increase will be 1.1 billion. Nigeria, with an estimated 103 million people in 1988, is expected to double its size by 2009, triple by 2024, and quadruple by 2035, adding 312 million people to the world's population in 50 years. By 2035, Nigeria is expected to surpass both the United States and the Soviet Union to become the third largest country in the world. In other words, the point which the UN and US population controllers never got around to telling third world women is that population growth is an asset after all, and not a liability, as the population controllers portray it. And the increase in population in Africa and the decrease in the United States has the U.S. military worried. By listening to the concerns of the military, we can understand a few basic truths about population. To begin with, it is in the U.S. national interest, and not in the interest of the countries in the receiving end of population aid, to promote population control programs. The U.S. does this as a way of preserving America's power in the absence of an expanding birth rate. This leads us to a series of corollary truths. First of all, population is the economic precondition for wealth and the military precondition for power. Even high-tech armies need a large population to support the industries which produce high-tech weapons. The expansion of the West, which began with Columbus's discoveries of the New World, was accompanied by an unprecedented demographic expansion, without which that colonial expansion would not have been possible. Technological development played a role in the dominance of the West, but, as Julian Simon has explained, technological development is not something which happens independently of population growth. The demographic constant in all of this is people producing wealth by providing for their families. The more people at hand, ceteris paribus, all things being equal, the more wealth that gets produced. Simon argues that in the long run, additional people actually cause food to be less scarce and less expensive and cause consumption to increase. How and why did total output and productivity per worker and per acre increase so fast? Supply increased so fast because of agricultural knowledge gained from research and development induced by the increased demand, together with the increased ability of farmers to get their produce to market on improved transportation systems. Population control is full of myths. However, the myths are intended primarily for public consumption. The truths are reserved for classified military documents. So in addition to the truth that people produce wealth, and so create, as a result, a world of non-finite resources, to use Simon's term, another truth emerged over the course of the 20th century as well. The well-off, at a certain point, stopped having large families. In 1944, King George VI of England established the Royal Commission on Population to examine the problem of national fertility decline and its implications for the British Commonwealth. The first fact that it established was the British stopped having large families. Everything else, every other demographic consequence, flowed from that fact. The widespread practice of birth control is undoubted, and our survey of the causes suggests that, although the extent and efficiency of its practice may vary, no changes in the social environment are likely to lead men and women to abandon this means of control over their circumstances. This fundamental and momentous adjustment to modern life has to be accepted as the starting point for consideration of the probable future trend of population. The Royal Population Commission came as well to the conclusion that the problem was not unique to England, but it was unique to the affluent West. Block quote. The modern fall in the size of the family towards and often below replacement levels is a phenomenon common to most of the peoples of the Western civilization and virtually confined to them. While their rate of increase has been drastically reduced in consequence during the present century, that of some Oriental peoples has undergone a marked acceleration as the result of a rapid fall in mortality, coupled with a continuance of high birth rates. It reminds one of another Englishman, says Jones, writing another sort of work at about the same time. In J.R.R. Tolkien's trilogy, Lord of the Rings, the Ring Fellowship notices that many of the houses of Minas Tirith are vacant. Worse still is the attitude of Denethor, who is charged with defending the city, but is secretly given into despair, believing that, quote, the West has failed. The Royal Population Commission deals with, quote, imponderable considerations of the moral sort as best they can. Block quote. There is much to be said for the view that a failure of society to reproduce itself indicates something wrong in its attitude to life, which is likely to involve other forms of decadence. The cult of childlessness and the vogue of the one-child family were symptoms of something profoundly unsatisfactory in the zeitgeist of the interwar period, which it may not be fanciful to connect with the sophistications and complacencies which contributed to the catastrophe of the Second World War. The Royal Commission traced the degeneration of English society to one root. The, quote, main cause, and very probably the only cause of this fall, was the spread of deliberate family limitation, end quote. Based on a specific attitude to life, the decline in family size was class-specific as well as proceeding, quote, fastest among the higher occupational categories, and considerably slower among Roman Catholics than in the rest of the population. This disparity in fertility linked to income and education led the commission to raise the specter of differential fertility, which haunted the eugenics movement before the war. Block quote. Of the social groups, those with the highest incomes, and among individual parents within each group, the better educated and the more intelligent have smaller families, on average, than others. We are not in a position to evaluate the expert evidence submitted to us to the effect that there is inherent in this differential birth rate a tendency toward lowering the average level of intelligence in the nation, but there is here an issue of the first importance which needs to be thoroughly studied. The ideology of population control is simply a combination of fact number one, people produce economic wealth and military power, and fact number two, the affluent have smaller families. The English upper classes converted to Darwinism at the same time that they stopped having large families. As a result, they began to be concerned about something they referred to as, quote, differential fertility, which meant that the, quote, best people, i.e. people of their class, limited the size of their families. The rest of the world, especially the pullulating races of the Southern Hemisphere, did not. As good Darwinians, they realized that the population with the higher fertility rate would eventually replace the population with lower fertility rate. Out of that fearful realization, the idea of population control was born. In its initial years, the eugenics movement called for, in Margaret Sanger's words, a nation of thoroughbreds, direct quote, as well as, quote, more children from the fit, fewer from the unfit. Sanger and her backers, of course, were supposed to determine the criteria of fitness along racial and class lines. The big parting of the waters for the eugenics movement came as a result of the excesses of one of its most fervent disciples, namely Adolf Hitler. Hitler did for eugenics what the politician named by Churchill did for sodomy. He gave it a bad name, And with the rise of the United States, he could note that German birth rates rose under Hitler. And with the rise of the United States as the world's dominant power after World War II, the country whose regime would rely heavily on advertising and public relations did what comes natural to such people. They changed the name of the Birth Control League to Planned Parenthood and set about to achieve the same goals as the eugenics movement, but by different means. The major changes in the eugenics movement, changes which took place after World War II, did not have to do with the ends the eugenicists wanted to achieve, but rather the means they chose to attain them. The same people were still concerned with differential fertility, but after the war, with the rise of mass communications media like TV and the influence tax-exempt foundations had over research in the universities, it became clear, at least in the affluent countries, that the best way to achieve eugenic goals was by psychological manipulation based on the capture of the means of communication. Get the people to do it to themselves. Portray demographic control as liberation. Portray an attempt to lower birth rates as concern for, quote, health. These ideas would reach their culmination in the sexual revolution of the 60s. The period from the end of World War II to the 60s saw a long, unsuccessful struggle on the part of the forces of moral restraint to stem the tide of illuminist politics, which can be defined as the ability to manipulate people through their vices. Illuminism is manipulating people through their vices. The Second Vatican Council was, in this respect, a major cultural counteroffensive on the part of the Catholic Church, but one which got quickly co-opted by the very instruments of culture it sought to tame. During the 60s, the Neo-Malthusians, a loose group of wealthy individuals and foundations with an Anglo-American point of view, gradually came to dominate the public consciousness through a series of well-financed and well-orchestrated publicity campaigns, the foremost of which was the overpopulation scare, which became the subject of congressional hearings in 1965, and thereafter was adopted as the cornerstone of foreign policy by the U.S. government. The milestones of this revolutionary movement are available from any history of birth control. The Draper Commission of 1959, followed by its rejection by President Eisenhower at the urging of the nation's Catholic bishops. This was followed by Lyndon Johnson mentioning the dangers of overpopulation in his 1965 State of the Union address. What no one could have known at the time is that Johnson did it at the express urging of John D. Rockefeller III and Bernard Berelson, who traveled to Washington during the fall of 1964 to a meeting for this express purpose. Johnson's announcement was followed in the spring of 65 by Griswold v. Connecticut, the Supreme Court decision which declared the ban on contraceptive sales unconstitutional. Leo Pfeffer was to say later that the court decriminalized contraception because the government wanted to get into the contraception business itself and could not very well dispense something illegal. Griswold was in turn followed for the next few years by the Gruning hearings. He was a senator from Alaska, famous as the only one to oppose the vote on the Vietnam War, I believe. Described by Phyllis Piotrow, Piotrow, as one of the most significant events in the contraceptive revolution, the Gruning hearings. During the course of the hearings, which were chaired by Senator Ernest Gruning of Alaska, a friend of Margaret Sanger, one expert after another, appeared before Congress urging the government's involvement in the promotion and distribution of contraceptives. By the end of the 60s, the United States was involved in the promotion of contraception both domestically and abroad. And again, we heard in an earlier chapter how the Catholic Church national organization didn't fight there where it really, really should have fought hard. So by the end of the 60s, so they've contraceptives go from illegal to being actively promoted by the U.S. government worldwide. From a nationalistic perspective, this involved a political self-contradiction because what weakened foreign nations also weakened America. But the contradiction is best explained by adding that those who proposed neo-Malthusian policies did not hold the good of the nation as their highest good. If population were a good thing, both economically and militarily, as just about every classified document concedes, why were the neo-Malthusians, Draper, Rockefeller, et al., interested in promoting birth control domestically? In order to answer that question, we have to define their position a bit more precisely. Hitler's position in this regard was more consistent. He supported abortion for non-Aryan peoples and opposed it for Aryans. Hitler was a German nationalist and a racist, where race was the conditio sine qua non, the absolutely essential thing or condition of citizenship. Unlike the more classical exponents of demographic politics, the neo-Malthusians were not acting in the national interest. They were acting in what they perceived as class interest, coinciding largely with an Anglo-American racial identification. This class was transnational and benefited from business dealings across the world. Beyond that, and perhaps most importantly, the Neo-Malthusians were also engaged in a revolutionary struggle at home. And we could bring in the New World Order here is the class they're loyal to and its scheme. Their first task was to take over the U.S. government and then use that government as the instrument of their policy abroad. In this regard, the promotion of birth control at home was not in the best interest of the United States because it accelerated the demographic weaknesses already in existence in the Neo-Malthusian classes, but it did make sense as a counterattack against domestic enemies. And since the Neo-Malthusians define the enemy as anyone on the other side of the differential fertility equation, promotion of birth control at home would strengthen their hand in their revolutionary struggle to change the default setting of the culture to something more congenial to their goals. The major domestic opponent to the Neo-Malthusian revolutionaries was, of course, the Catholic Church. The first birth control offensive was a domestic campaign aimed at Catholics and blacks because those groups had the highest fertility rates. Population control got practiced at home before it got exported. The sexual revolution of the 60s was, in effect, a demographic attack on Catholics that was so successful that within a period of 10 years, it effectively neutralized the only effective domestic opposition to the eugenics regime. One need only look around to see how effective the assault on the Catholic position opposing population control was. In many ways, it was a disinformation campaign of unprecedented strategic genius. The Catholics were the main force driving the post-World War II baby boom. As the National Security Council could have predicted, with demographic growth came both economic power and political power. In 1960, the first Catholic president in the history of a very anti-Catholic country was elected president. The demographic handwriting was on the wall. The United States was on its way to becoming a Catholic country. At least, this is what the Neo-Malthusians, versed in, if not obsessed with, demographics, must have thought. And then the contraceptive put an end to all that by ending the baby boom demographically and dividing the Catholic opposition intellectually. The blacks lost the demographic wars of the 60s, too, in a much more dramatic fashion. As a result of contraceptive-oriented poverty programs, the black family was all but destroyed. Illegitimacy went from 20 to 70%. Black leadership was held hostage first to the foundations, like Ford, which funded the civil rights movement, and then to the federal government. By the mid-70s, the Neo-Malthusians had effectively taken over the government and were then free to implement their eugenics theories as government policy. Population control, after serving as the vehicle for subjugating enemies at home, became the instrument for the same sort of subjugation abroad. In the meantime, the same Neo-Malthusian campaign applied domestically continued to drive the birth rate down and increase the differential fertility, which drove the campaign in the first place. Ironically, if the Neo-Malthusians had really concentrated on raising the standard of living in the Third World, which is what they claimed to be doing, they might have brought about the decline in fertility they desired, but for people who claim to have the big picture in view, they proved to be remarkably short-sighted. The results of the Neo-Malthusian revolution of the 60s have, as a result, been an unmitigated disaster. Domestically, it led to the destruction of the black family, the undermining of democratic institutions, and the establishment of sexual liberation as a means of political control, a control that few seem to recognize and virtually no one knows how to end. In terms of foreign policy, it proved to be a disaster in a different way, especially to our, quote, friends, i.e. anyone who allowed the USAID a free rein in his country. By the mid-80s, Indira Gandhi, Anwar Sadat, the Shah of Iran, and Ferdinand Marcos were all either out of work or dead, killed or expelled by their own people rebelling against the imposition of population control. What they had in common was a supine acceptance of American population control measures adopted to the detriment of their own people, who reacted in predictably violent ways. Indira Gandhi was assassinated by her own bodyguard in 1984. 3 years earlier, the same fate befell Anwar Sadat, who, according to one biographer, quote, boasted that David and Nelson Rockefeller, the magnates of the Chase Manhattan Bank, as well as Robert McNamara, the president of the World Bank, were his personal friends, and therefore he could make use of his private connections in the world to produce a turnabout in the economy. Sadat was aware of the fate of the Shah, also a friend of the Rockefellers, whose wife, like the wife of Ferdinand Marcos, had taken control of Iran's population control program. Sadat's fate was more like Gandhi's than the Shah's. On October 6, Sadat was assassinated by a young artillery officer who hoped to usher into being Egypt, the same Islamic era which had dawned in Iran 2 years earlier. According to Fred Sheikh, S-C-H-I-E-K, according to Fred Sheikh, Manila director of the U.S. Agency for International Development in the 80s, Imelda Marcos took, quote, direct personal and public interest in population control programs in the Philippines, administering $70 million worth of pills, condoms, and IUDs to fellow Filipinos. But by the end, even she began to realize that the aid intervention in her country was going to prove as personally disastrous to her as it had been to other condom pushers. By mid-1985, a year before the Marcos government fell, Imelda was telling Sheikh that she would continue collaborating behind the scenes, but had to withdraw her public support because it had become so unpopular. 2 years later, or no, 2 years late, well, maybe a typo there. 2 years late, aid operatives were complaining that the Aquino government was, quote, kowtowing to the church, which was their way of saying that it was not implementing the same policies which had led to the fall of the Marcos regime. As we end the chapter, coercion never works over the long run, certainly not in areas intimate as having children, and running roughshod over clients always seemed to bring on a backlash. But beyond that, the neo-Malthusians seemed to have created the very scenario they feared the most, a fact noted by Alfred Sauvy, S-A-U-V-Y, who warned that the Malthusian propaganda and fears of overpopulation would affect most the very people who were most reluctant to have children. The fear of seeing others multiply, he wrote, quote, thus leads to a diminishing vitality, to a recrudescence of Malthusian attitudes in populations already sapped by demographic aging. At the same time, the populations that elicited those fears remain unaffected. The usual perils of preachers who address only the already converted are therefore compounded by the risk of reducing their very numbers from one generation to the next. Thus, the spread in levels of fertility between countries, regions, and social classes, and so on, is further extended, even though the goal was to narrow the gaps. Which may be just another way of saying, says Jones, that the meek will inherit the earth. Of course, he doesn't have a problem with the earth being taken over by a lot of dusky third world masses who are anything but meek. Now, they're just stupid and violent, but they're pullulating, as he says. They're numerous. So there you go, the reality behind population control and birth control. That if you go to the military documents, they will acknowledge that population is strength, not weakness. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll do part 3, chapter 18, as we make our way through the last 60-plus pages of Libido Dominandi.